This is Wade Rathke, and you're listening to Wade's World. It's 9 in the morning, Friday morning, Central Standard Time in the United States, and your time for the voice of the people. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, where KABF 88.3 is located, or the east side of New Orleans, where WAMF 90.3 is housed, or Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay, points east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at www.kabf.org. A podcast will be available to the show on Monday at that website. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. Today, we're going Hollywood. We're talking to Joey Carey of Sundial Pictures about his new movie he's been producing called, The Organizer. Welcome to Wade's World, Joey.
Glad to be here.
So, Joey, I know a lot about this film because I've had a small part in it, and it's been going on forever. Is this normal, these documentaries? You've done a lot of them, but how many years is it you've been working on this movie? It's about to have its world premiere.
We started filming down here in 2010.
So 2010, 7 years.
Pretty good. I would say that's on the longer side of what a documentary usually takes. You know, but films are take a lot of work. I think if you start a film and finish it within 2 years, you're doing pretty good.
And is that based on financing or film or subject matter or what?
Based on the story, how the events unfold, what festival you get into, what your deadlines are. You know, this was a big story. A lot of history and a contemporary storyline unfolding, and financing was hard, so everybody's working other jobs and trying to fit this in around stuff to make ends meet. And it took a lot longer than we hoped, but we're happy to be where we're at right now.
We want to look under the hood at this whole process and give listeners to Wade's World a real sense of, you know, this strange, exotic, fascinating movie world of our time. But give people a little synopsis of what The Organizer is as a documentary.
Well, The Organizer is a film about organizing, community organizing, labor organizing, and your history and involvement building Acorn and the work you're doing now. So the film covers some history and some of the contemporary work going on.
And that's it originally started, at least in one iteration, sort of a citizen wealth, and now it's become a lot more personal. And I'm always very careful. These are artists, Joey and his partner, who's directed, I guess, most of the film, Nick Taylor from Toronto, and it's their film, and I'm just hoping to ride this Bronco the best I can. But so, how much film did y'all end up getting? This is 90 minutes, I read.
It runs, the final runtime right now for our festival version is 101 minutes, including the credits.
Okay.
And we must have shot almost 300 hours worth of footage, you know, and that doesn't include even the archival research aspect of it, where you're pouring through old tapes and reel-to-reel format stuff from 1975 that had to be baked in an oven to get the mold off of and transferred to a digital format to be
able
to review.
And that's what I tell you, the little pieces I've seen, bits and pieces of the film, some of the archival footage is some of the, I mean, obviously, I like that a lot because some of those things I have never seen, and some of them are obviously old memories, but there's a story behind that as well. Didn't y'all do some work with the archives at the State Historical Society in Wisconsin?
Yep.
How did that work?
Well, we ended up going to the Wisconsin Historical Society, two separate trips that Nick and I both made, and we worked out a deal with them where they said they had all these unprocessed archives, meaning it's literally sitting in boxes, nobody's gone through it, they've been sent over there, there's some notes, whatever. So nobody knows what's on there.
And
so
we
said both film, video, papers, photos, all this stuff.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So it becomes the job of, it fell on our shoulders saying, oh, we want to use it. Well, we got to figure out what it is. Half the time it's formats, old formats that are not easy to even watch anymore. So we worked out a deal with them where they would let us take all of their old video formats, and we sent them to a place called VTape in Toronto. Gave us a good deal on transferring all of it and digitizing all that footage.
Because if you're a certain age, you remember there, you know, in the way that people have controversy between Microsoft and Apple, between Android and, you know, Apple, Beta and VHS used to be a thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I can remember my brother, you get Beta's the best, you got to stick with Beta. And, you know, we had Beta stuff, but some of that stuff must have been in Beta, which is
There's
long
Beta,
gone.
VHS, Digibeta tapes, half-inch, quarter-inch, reel-to-reel, you know, these are things that
were... Is that typical in documentary work when you have to get archival stuff, or is this unusual just because you were looking almost 45, 50 years in the past?
It's hard to say there's anything typical in this kind of work.
Okay.
It's about the project, and you know, this project, which dealt with a long history where Acorn started in 1970, and there's stuff from then on, and other films I've been involved with have had to deal with similar issues. So it's fairly commonplace when doing historical documentary work that you find archives that are personal archives that have been sitting in someone's basement for 40, 50 years. You don't know what you're going to deal with, but that kind of digitizing process is pretty common to do.
So 101 minutes out of 300 hours, y'all could...
That's an estimate, you know.
Okay, well, you know, plus or minus, más o menos. Y'all could do, you know, 5 or 6 completely different films about this.
Oh, we tried. We wanted to. At one point, we wanted to get a broadcaster or somebody like Netflix or Amazon to come on board and say, let's do a 6-part miniseries. And, you know, like many things.
And they said, no happy ending.
They said, cool.
We don't spend freedom in our time, so.
They said, send us a rough cut and we'll see what we like it. So, you know, in the experience I've had, which is the indie film world, it is easier to make a feature-length film. You send it to festivals, you try to get a big premiere at a well-known top-tier film festival and attract the attention of a distributor, who will then pick your film up, hopefully they put some marketing money behind it, and they release it in theaters and online, on iTunes, they close deals with Netflix, Amazon, etc. That's a general workflow for how these things go. So,
and you've done how many films at this point, Joey? Because you're not an elderly gentleman.
You've maybe been involved in 15 or so, maybe 20, depending on the length and different
stuff.
And
of those 15, 20, how much have worked on that sort of regime?
Pretty much all of them, because the indie film world is hard and the power lies in the hands of the distributors, who say they can sit back, you figure out how to raise money and finish the film, send us a rough cut, or you let us know when it's premiering at Sundance and we'll come check it out and see if we want it. But it's hard to get someone on board ahead of time.
But you don't have a distribution deal yet for this film.
Nope, but we're waiting.
We're ready.
Tomorrow night.
So that's...
last night.
Yeah, that's tomorrow was... it's the world premiere is at the New Orleans Film Festival. And then there's a East Coast premiere in Woodstock, New York. Famous for Woodstock, obviously. But also... What is that, 2 hours outside of New York City?
It's about 2 hours north of New York in the foothills of the Catskills.
There you go. So, and then it's been accepted on another festival recently as well. It's somewhere near Las Vegas. So.
Yeah,
Red Rock Film Festival,
Southern Utah.
In Cedar something, Utah.
Yeah, we're working out the details still.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Okay, so it's all a process, and... So on this film, it's obviously got some interest in terms of those of us who are involved in organizing. Is there a different strategy on this film than there might be on other films in terms of how you approach it as a producer?
Well, yeah, we are going to do multiple things with this film. We're going to continue down the route of the film festival run. We want to play in a whole bunch of film festivals, and we hope that that will attract the attention of a distributor. We're also going to start doing one-off screenings, which in the film world it's called non-theatrical screenings, where oftentimes it's a university hosts a screening. Sometimes it's in collaboration with a workshop or a visiting artist or an event or something that goes on surrounding the film as well. Community screenings, these are things that we want to launch as part of a grassroots campaign across the country to bring this film to places where groups exist that are interested in this type of work, that are trying to get organized or are currently organizing and want to expand their engagement with their local community. So we see this film as really a tool that can be used to help build power among communities. It's as simple as that. So we hope that through both the festival run and this grassroots screening campaign, we will get the attention of a distributor with a lot of these types of screenings acting as word-of-mouth publicity for the film, marketing this movie that will make it easier for a distributor to release the film on more traditional platforms.
So obviously, you got an early boost from crowdfunding.
Yep. We ran a whole Kickstarter campaign and raised over $30,000 through small donations with friends and family. It's a lot of work. We got there, and that helped us get the film basically to a rough cut, close to a rough cut.
So you put together the money from, you know, various patchworks of, you know, crowdfunding and individual donors and volunteer labor and whatever you and Nick put together. When you talk about a grassroots campaign, that obviously doesn't pay back the investment, does it?
Well, it depends on who's showing the film. And there are other films that I've worked on with some colleagues of mine where we have represented the non-theatrical educational rights to films, because oftentimes universities have budgets set aside to bring films from abroad or from wherever with the director or with the main subject or producer to come and put that film on at their school. And they have budgets to pay for those rights. It's called public performance rights. Ranges from $100 for a screening to over $1,000 if it includes, you know, bringing the whole team into town and doing a workshop of some sort around the film. So we see our campaign as being a combination of those. We want to show this movie. We don't want budgets to get in the way. We're going to do what we can to bring it to places that are interested in showing it, that are interested in organizing. We're also going to ask different places that can afford it to help us pay for the costs of these things, because there's money involved in all of it, and this film has to try to make back the money that was spent on it. We have to try to cover costs for people who are traveling to show the film somewhere and trying to organize different parts of the country. So it'll be a combo of those things.
So if I were, we're talking to Joey Carey, who's a producer and major domo in Sundial Films out of New York, who's got a world premiere of a film called The Organizer, a documentary coming out both on the East Coast and in the South. And we're talking to him about how all this really works. So if you're an enterprising young or old filmmaker, documentary, what do you look at is how to raise $100,000 to do everything, and then how to then pay it back and sell enough tickets and the kind of strategies you're talking about? Is that a rule of thumb, or is it 50,000, or is it 200,000?
How does? Well, are you speaking about this screening campaign in particular, or just?
I'm just
film?
Speaking about if you know you were starting another effort here.
Well,
if you were listening out here and said, "Okay,
let's make a new documentary.
I got a good camera. I think I'll, I mean I had a guy, for example, good guy, who came in at KBF and wanted to do a film about KBF. And he was going to put it all together. Now, I haven't seen him recently, but for $5,000, he was going to do it. And da, da, da. And I said, really? Wow. And I haven't seen him recently. Did I say that? But he was a good guy, and, you know, we opened the doors to him and whatever. But I'm betting that's not typical.
Well, that is a pretty small budget to do this sort of work on.
And that's probably an understatement.
You know, if you don't pay yourself and you don't pay anyone involved and you make a film that you can edit on your laptop at home and you already own the camera, it's possible you can do anything. I mean, and I tell people all the time, you want to make a movie? Making a movie. Nobody's stopping you. This is
YouTube.
Documentary filmmaking. You have all the tools in front of you nowadays with quality equipment that is somewhat affordable. You can go and make your film. It's not easy and takes a lot of time and energy, and unless you have some other way to keep the lights on, you're going to have to take, you know, work if you're not paying yourself for it. So, you know, we've done that also. This film is a big example of that. You figure it out, you know. But it really, the way it works is you want to raise money to be able to hire the right team. You want to be able to pay yourself so you can spend your time working on this project, you know. And you do that through applying for grants. Most of the time you don't get them. You do that through applying to different types of independent film organizations, labs and workshops that they host, and conferences, because it helps raise the profile of your film. So Sundance has a lot of these. Tribeca Film Institute, Independent Film Project, IFP does this. CineReach is a great organization. There's a whole bunch of different indie film organizations established to support filmmakers, both helping them raise financing and helping them meet the right partners to help get their film made. So those things are something that really help you, help your film stand out from the pack. But you still have to go out and raise money, because it's never going to be it's almost never a one-off, boom, you got all your budget.
Because so in you a piecemeal it together. You're still, I mean, most people still think of movies like Blade Runner or whatever. It's going to be, you know, whatever, Blade Runner 2049, whatever the name of the current movie is. It's going to be in all these theaters, and you're going to read about how they do and how many millions it costs them. But on a documentary, if you're not, I don't know who would be a good example of somebody who does documentary in regular theaters.
You know, you could be, unless you're Alex Gibney or Michael Moore.
Yeah, I was thinking Michael Moore.
It's hard to get anybody to sign on to your
concept.
You're
not going to be in 1,000 theaters.
No.
So it's always going to be some kind of adaptation strategy, whether it's your grassroots campaign that you're describing for the organizer or something else. So,
well, other things that come up which are changing the model of what can work for smaller independent films are, you know, platforms like Netflix. Netflix does not rely on a number of sales of tickets or sales for downloads or anything. It just relies on its subscribers, and it wants to continue building its subscription base. So what they need is quality content that people want to see. And they have their own metrics. They track it all. They don't release that info. It's all private to them. It's gold.
Yeah.
So, but for them, they can say, hey, I'm going to pick up a film because we care about it, because we think this is important, or because we think people like this, and it's going to help build our subscription base. So they're not tied to the old model of sales and downloads, whereas a lot of other distributors, the theater chains need ticket sales, those are the exhibitors, the distributors get a cut of all that, they need iTunes to people actually buy your movie on iTunes, which is pretty hard to get people to do nowadays. So the subscription-based platforms like Netflix or Amazon Prime Streaming, and there's a bunch of other ones out, those are probably the two biggest. That type of a model could work. It's somewhat like what the broadcast model used to be, where they needed to sell airtime to advertisers for your program. So they'd look at your program and say, well, who wants to advertise on this show? Don't know who wants to advertise that much on the organizer, but Netflix isn't based on ads, based on subscribers. So those types of models fit a little bit better with an independent film.
Oh, and friends tell me, oh, well, I guess I'm not going to be in this city or that city where it's showing. I'll get it on Netflix. They're making an assumption that Netflix has everything, and I'm hearing you say you still got to sell it to Netflix.
Oh, yeah. Definitely still have to sell it to Netflix, and they don't often pick up a film directly. When they do, it's generally called a Netflix original. They put their tag of Netflix originals on it, even if they didn't have anything to do with making it. They saw it at Sundance, they decided to buy it for $10 million and put their, you know, logo on it.
If you buy something for $10 million, you ought to be able to put the word original on it.
They can make it an organizer original.
Yeah,
all good.
You would make that deal. Come on now.
But they also do licensing deals where they will pick up the rights from a distributor, and maybe it's a 1 or 2 year long deal for a certain amount of fee up front to license it and put it on Netflix. And once that deal expires, they either have to renew it, or you can take it and put it on a different platform and license those rights out to someone else.
So for an independent filmmaker like yourself, you try to get a distribution deal Because you want more eyeballs on the film, or because you need to pay back the cost of the film?
Well, both.
Yeah, but it's never both.
I mean, we need to pay back the cost of the film.
That's okay.
But, you know, depending on what the distribution deal is, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to make that money back anyway. Most distributors for a smaller film aren't even giving you any kind of advance up front. A bigger deal would include an advance. So they'd say, Netflix maybe comes in and says, hey, we'll give you, you know, $100,000 for the rights to put it on our platform as an exclusive. You can only get it on Netflix. They still recoup those funds through other sales. You know, Netflix is probably a bad example here. A bigger distributor, Magnolia Pictures, would do that. And they would license it out, and they would get it to all these different outlets, and they would put it on Netflix.
And what kind of outlets would they get it to for a documentary?
iTunes, you know, they want it on iTunes. Your pay-per-view type of platform. Your top box set is really what it would be. So, you know, Time
top
Warner.
Top box set? What is it?
Like your Time Warner box where you can buy it through your cable box, your cable provider. And so that's often regional.
I'm trying to learn the lingo here, Joe.
Yeah, I know.
I want to get hip here. Yeah. And instead of the listeners, we want to be able to top box thing. We want to know what we're talking about here. We've already learned your educational thing, and there was some other alternative release, whatever. I meant to write it down, but you'll remind me before we leave. Okay, so you gotta pay back, and then the distributor makes their money by selling it wherever they can. Once again, they just want the money.
They want the money.
Head. It's not like somebody says, hey, I've got 1,000 people up here in, you know, State College. You want to desperately see that. They're not saying, okay, I'll take $2.
No, usually, so what we will do with this especially is, unless there's a distributor who actually has a track record of successfully handling educational, non-theatrical rights, we'll carve those rights out, is what it's called. We'll keep those rights to ourselves, and we'll only license the digital, theatrical, broadcast, subscription, streaming rights to a distributor to handle those. And we'll say, we're going to do our own non-theatrical educational campaign, because we'll actually do it. Often those are things that a distributor will take, and it sits, they don't do anything with it. It's not really worth their while because it's smaller and it's a lot of work and takes somebody actually dedicating time to reach out to all the different institutions and community groups to actually set up any of these screenings. So we usually hold those back.
But you also, just like the big timers, you worry about people getting it on the internet and, you know, ripping you off, right?
Yep, for sure. I mean, it's happened with other films that someone gets a hold of a link or hacks into an account and they steal your movie and they put it up for free somewhere. And it's, once it happens, it's really hard to get it taken down. So that's something that in the eyes of a distributor really lowers the value of the product. Because if it's available for free online, who's going to buy it from them?
Well, at what point in the process do you actually make CDs and sell them?
Well, DVDs.
DVDs.
We would do for, you know, the lingo here. You know this lingo.
We all want to learn. We don't want to embarrass ourselves in public.
Well, a lot of times what happens is those educational, non-theatrical rights coincide with DVD and Blu-ray rights, because a lot of universities will want to host a screening and also purchase a DVD for their library so that anybody can come back from their student body and take it out and watch it on their own time. So we like that. It means we end up talking about how to handle those rights with the distributor, because they still do put DVDs out in big box stores. They are available and, you know, across the country, and it is a way that people still do consume media through DVD and Blu-ray. Not quite like they used to. It's all going digital.
But in this process, when does that happen? Towards the tail end?
Further down the road, yeah. You know, we haven't quite got there yet in our strategy. We'll probably start doing that soon, because it's another way that we can sell back of the room DVD rights. Kind of like if you had a book that you were working on and you were selling after a talk, you would sell it afterwards. But we would have a screening and have the DVDs and Blu-rays available for people to purchase as gifts or to bring home. So we'll start working on that fairly soon, but that's different than a distributor picking up the rights for DVD and Blu-ray and putting it out in those big stores. Sort of separate rights that we would carve out and can keep our ability to do that.
Well, you know, but a schlepper like me knows how to sell books and CDs. So, you know, that's part of why I'm interested. So hey. If I was doing something and... Let me tell you, y'all gave me a couple of little links that I showed in Paris to the Acorn International organizers. Oh, mercy. I had people in, on the Katrina section, tears in the eyes. I mean, I could have sold every one of those folks a CD if I'd had them,
We're going to get you a bunch.
Yeah, well, now we're talking. Now we're happy. We're talking to Joey Carey of Sundial Pictures, who's been working for, he says, 7 years now. The time just flies by on his film called The Organizer, which is having its debut. We've been learning a lot about this. Do you have any other projects that you've got coming online soon too, Joey? Or?
Well, we've got a project that we're just starting production on. It's about well-known tattoo artist Mark Mahoney. He's known as one of the founders of the black and gray tattoo movement. He started tattooing in the 70s in Boston, where he's from, and then New York, and then moved to LA, where it was really happening. And this is a tattoo movement that came out of prison tattoos, really. A guy named Freddie Negrete, who now works with Mark at his shop.
His real name, Freddie Negrete? Freddie,
hey, I don't ask.
Love that. You gotta love that.
And he's, they're really kind of like the godfathers of this movement, which was, at the time, an underdog movement. Tattoos were colorful, thick lines, cartoony, different style. This was, they were doing black and gray only, and very photorealist style. So, we're just starting to work on it. Mark is a great character. He now is, tattooer of all the celebrities and everybody in LA, as well as anybody who can get on his list. That's like 6 months out if you want a tattoo from him. But we're just starting that one. So.
Yeah, I'm not a big tattoo guy. I like to think as an organizer I keep up with movements, but I'm not familiar with the gray and black tattoo movement. So that'll be an interesting film for people, without a doubt. And sometimes when I mention you in this film, people talk about some sushi thing. Is that a famous Joey Carey production in sushi world? What are we talking about?
We worked on a film called Jiro Dreams of Sushi, which came out four years ago now, I think, and it got very well known through Netflix, and it was on Netflix, and Magnolia Pictures was the distributor that picked it up, and it played in theaters across the country. This is a film made by David Gelb, who now went on to make Chef's Table, which is on Netflix, and he's made a few other films since then. So it's a documentary about the world's best sushi chef in Tokyo, Jiro Ono, and it was beautifully shot, and it kind of started this whole wave of food documentaries, beautifully shot, and stories about chefs and, a culture around food. So
you're specializing in these, counterculture, otherworldly things, tattoos, sushi, organizing. Is that sort of
an
independent filmmaker, plots a career, Joey, or...?
I don't know if I was thinking about my career when I did this. It just sort of happened. It's the stories come to you,
I don't.
It's
they come
hard.
To you, or you have to go out and get them. Because certainly with this film, y'all went out and got it, right?
Well, it comes to you, and you have to go out and make it. So it doesn't show up done and ready on your footstep. But you realize, this is a movie that we wanted to make, a film that was important, and you can't go into making a film like this unless it's something you cannot live without making. The number of times over the course of these 7 years trying to make this movie that the frustration and stress levels are through the roof, and you're trying to figure out how to raise money and how to get it to the next phase, and it's, if you don't have the motivation and thick skin, it's going to sit on the shelf and you're never going to get it done.
So, Joey, we have a minute or so left. People want to keep up with the progress of this film or find out when they can see it on Netflix or get a D
DVD, not a CD. That's the music world. DVD. How do they get a hold of you or Sundial or whatever?
Well, you can email me at joey@sundialpictures.com, and you can go to our website, sundialpictures.com, and theorganizerfilm.com. We would love to hear from anybody looking to host a screening, anybody who wants more info. We're going to be updating on social media and our newsletter, so let us know.
Hey, sounds good. This has been Wade's World for another week. We promise the most interesting people in the world, and this was an interesting one. This has been Wade's World, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang in the beginning, things you've never seen and will never forget. As the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week, when we have another guest, and I think it's likely to be Nick Taylor, the director of this film. We'll get to hear the other perspective. This is Wade Rathke from Wade's World. Thank you.